Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels. And our guest this week, we have Scott McIntune from Minnesota Department of Natural Resources back on the show. We've had Scott on plenty of times before. He's kind of one of my go-to guys anytime I have a science-y or kind of a biology type of topic come up. And in this particular case, aquatic vegetation. I mean, year-round, finding fish in vegetation and the plant life is always a fishy conversation. That being said, I wanted to dedicate this show to really getting specific and getting more educated on plant types and just, you know, the life cycle and just how, you know, the plants that are most meaningful and why to anglers. And Scott being an angler himself, I think he's kind of one of the perfect guys. I like having him on because he can kind of, you know, he can speak on the sciencey stuff and make it relatable to anglers. And definitely, I think so many of us, and this is a multi-species conversation, but as anglers, many of us reach a point where if we got a lot of things figured out, you know, as far as our strategy to break down water and find fish and catch fish, you can definitely reach a point where, you know, if we got a little bit more educated on aquatic vegetation, being able to identify it correctly and know a little bit about it, you know, I think that definitely can help us be better anglers and find ways to utilize the information to catch more fish, especially as it pertains to pattern fishing. When we're putting patterns together, it is not unreasonable to think on any given body of water or in a region or, you know, in an area with a bunch of lakes that are similar, you know, I think these patterns are transferable like that, certain times a year, there's going to be a strong preference for different vegetation, you know, just based on how it is structured or, you know, the depth that you start to see it in. I mean, Scott addresses a lot of angles to this topic in this interview. And I just find that it's definitely educational. I think a lot of us could take away from it. And I do, I'll say it again. I think it's true that as anglers, we can definitely reach a point where educating ourselves, correctly on aquatic vegetation, species, being able to identify it, maybe think a little bit more thoughtful about, you know, why I'm finding fish in a certain spot in and around this, this edge habitat, is definitely going to help us put patterns together and break down water even more proficiently and or take these patterns from lake to lake and just communicate it better. Sometimes you get on a bite and, you know, you figure this stuff out and, you know, you want to share information with your fishing buddies. You know, being able to, you know, include this in your conversation to help you communicate, I think, a lot better, fishing information. So I think it all plays in. It definitely is a topic that we can get better at and we can be better anglers and catch more fish because of it. So anyways, I'm just rambling on there. And you know what? You know, in the intro here, I'm talking aquatic vegetation, you know, aquatic plants. I'm saying that intentionally because in this interview, you're going to hear me say weeds a lot. I think anglers are going to know what I'm referring to, but for any of the more correct thinkers and talkers out there, out of respect for the botanists of the world, you know, weeds, you know, by definition is something growing or something less valued. I think, you know, closer to the definition being something not valued where it's growing, a plant that is not valued or unwanted where it is growing. That's not what I'm referring to. I just want to throw that little disclaimer out there, but because I do use the word weeds a lot in this interview, and but I think anglers are going to know what I'm talking about. So anyways, we've got Scott McIntune, aquatic vegetation. Let's get to it. This episode of the JMO Podcast is brought to you by Chalet on Mille Lacs. The Chalet on Mille Lacs has all your lodging needs and more for your next vacation on Mille Lacs Lake near Garrison, Minnesota. And when I say this lodging opportunity has all your needs and more, I'm talking about two private shorelines, including a protected channel to safely park your boat overnight, a great outdoor feature you're not going to find everywhere on the lake, a game room, high-speed Wi-Fi, you're minutes away from the casino and golf course. The indoor and outdoor amenities of the Chalet on Mille Lacs epitomize comfort and convenience with a 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom that includes 2 masters, a large kitchen, all the indoor amenities that are perfect for large groups or multi-families. This cabin comfortably sleeps 8. You can add more if you like. Read the reviews from past guests on the website or book directly at Chalet on Mille Lacs. That's www.chaletonmillelacs.com. The link is in the description of this podcast. I just thought, you know, even for myself, I think a lot of people out there, you know, identifying weeds, I probably don't know as many weeds as I should know. Like, as many weeds as I go fishing and, you know, I start to put a pattern together. I think that's a big part of this conversation too, is like pattern fishing being what it is. If we can all get smarter at truly identifying these weeds, and then also being able to interpret them on electronics when you're going through side scan, you know, you can kind of see what, if you know what a weed, if you know how to identify a weed because you've seen the pictures or you see it in real life, you know how it stands up or you know how it leans over, you know how big the leaves are, you can start to see this stuff on electronics. You can put fish patterns together. I think it's a very fishy conversation and just kind of a fun sort of sciencey conversation at the same time, and that's what I always call you for. So anyways, I'm just laying down some groundwork here to call you, and I want to talk about identifying, you know, some of the fishiest weeds that we have here in the Midwest. I mean, you work over in Minnesota. We can talk about Minnesota, but just generally speaking, the most popular, the most relevant to anglers weed types that we have around here. And you know, in your experience, like how do you, describe them and maybe identify them, talk about them, just sort of any of the fun things. And then let's just see where this conversation takes us, man.
I would just break it down into submerged, emergent, and floating leaf. In our submerged plants that have the finely divided leaves, that's things like bladderwort, northern water milfoil, whitewater crowfoot or buttercup, of course, Eurasian water milfoil, which is an exotic and invasive. Oh, coontail, that's a big one. You'll see a lot of that. And I'd probably, leave it there. That's where your finely divided plants are. And I think if you think about milfoil or you think about coontail or you think about the bladderworts, they're just little tiny, the leaves are set apart with just these little strands that sort of come out. And that's how you see those arrangements. They have leaflets rather than individual leaves. And you can kind of count those and look at how they're set up. But those are big kind of bunchy plants that'll grow up. And they do provide great fishing cover and great habitat. You know, you'll talk about wanting to find fish in the milfoil, bass anglers getting on milfoil edges, punching through the slop. You know, that's that really heavy stuff that they're fishing through. And a lot of times it can be beds of thick, thick milfoil. Sometimes it's Eurasian, sometimes it's northern water milfoil. That's finely divided. You know, I'd go into, the full entire leaf types of plants, your cabbage that people think of. We can run through a bunch of those. There's large leaf pondweed, there's white stem pondweed, there's Illinois pondweed, there's Richardson's pondweed. These are all the Potamogetons, that particular genus or genera of plants. Fern leaf pondweed, there's just tons of them. Long leaf pondweed, floating leaf pondweed. There's a ton of different plants in that group, and that's what everyone's referring to when they're talking about fishing cabbage. And generally speaking, the larger the leaf size and the more lush, kind of the better. And that's just the idea of spacing and surface area and area, you know, little pockets for fish to hide out in. And that cuts both ways, right? We've got predator fish that want to use it for cover and places to hang out in ambush, and for small fish that want to have that cover as well. And they just become something of a buffet, right? There's lots of invertebrates that are hanging out in those areas. Even zooplankton will sit and hide underneath the shade and the cover of vegetation just to get away from visual predators. So it's just a home to so much life. So broadleaf, submerged plants.
You know, maybe there's some minority type of weeds, but you see them in specific places. I think of when you go up to Leech Lake, you know, it's sandgrass, you know, in the spring, you know, at opener, it's shallow flats, you know, finding the sandgrass, finding the shiner minnows, and the walleyes are chasing them. Like, is that just a Leech Lake thing, or what, you know, where does that fit into this conversation? Like, how widespread is that? And what's sandgrass?
So you're describing a plant that's called Kara. It's a macroalgae. It's also called muskgrass. This is the kind of thing when you run your hooks through it and you bring it up off the bottom and you hold it, it's got a really sandy feel to it. And that's not the sand from the lake bottom. That's actually pieces of lime that are forming around it from just the chemical reaction. And then it's got a smell. It's called muskgrass because it smells like a skunk. And this carpet of plants will extend out into some very deep water at times, but it covers up sandy, silty areas, and it's absolutely phenomenal for fish. Again, because of forming that carpet on the bottom of the lake, providing food sources for invertebrates, and just providing cover for fish. It's a known spawning substrate for a number of fish species. I know you mentioned Leech Lake. If you're up in Sucker Bay, there's a big chunk of aquatic management area that's been set aside that was purchased specifically because it was a known musky spawning area. And there's a whole lot of muskgrass that's offshore that provides some of that cover. So you're absolutely right. You talk about sandgrass, you talk about Kara or muskgrass. We're talking about the same plant. It's critically important as fish habitat. And it's good for anglers to key in on. Like, I mean, it's in some places it's ubiquitous. It's just growing, covering all over the bottom, and then maybe it's all looking the same. But in other places, if you find patches of it, you're more likely to find the fish on the patches, on the edges. You got to think about, and most anglers do, you know, fish being creatures of edge, creatures of habit, of finding edge habitat, and that standing out to them more than just bare naked open spaces. So yeah, absolutely. You're not wrong about getting on the sandgrass.
Let's maybe talk a little bit about life cycle or just the time of year. Let's maybe go through a standard kind of flow of like which are, you know, the plant types that you typically see emerging first, or anglers should be keying in on, you know, say in the spring of the year. Like if you're in Minnesota, Wisconsin, like in and around the opener for inland lakes, like, you know, if there's emerging weeds, you know, maybe kind of talk about it in that regard, sort of chronologically, like how do these plants emerge and start being attractive to anglers, in your opinion, and moving along through the season?
Well, first, I think it's good to point out that these plants, these aquatic plants, have unique life histories, and they might set up slightly different than, you know, what you see in a terrestrial landscape. You know, we're used to, in some respects they're similar too, right? These plants senesce, they lay down for the season going into the winter. I shouldn't put it that way. They don't always necessarily lay down, but they sort of cease to photosynthesize and operate throughout the winter. They're very dependent upon the conditions. So some lakes have extremely clear water. Some, they'll have enough sunlight penetration that those plants can still stay up and stay green. But you're kind of looking at these plants like structure and structure only. Like they're holding up and they're providing that cover. They're still attractive to fish, particularly as they're still green. Some of them will still hold up and turn brown, and some of them will lay down flat, you know, just completely start to decompose and break apart and offer almost nothing. So there's a really wide kind of range of outcomes for these plants entering fall and winter. But yeah, some of them will stay up depending on the species, depending on the lake characteristics, what kind of winter we have, how much sunlight they're getting. And those plants can kind of jump back into things. They can produce new shoots, new leaves, get reestablished and begin growing again. But typically there's a little bit of a lag. One of the first plants that really comes on strong, and it's got pretty widespread distribution, is an exotic plant. I'd almost argue it's naturalized. It's curly leaf pondweed. So this is a member of that Potamogeton group. It's Potamogeton crispus. It's curly leaf pondweed. This is the thing, you pull it out of the water and it stays crispy. It's got these rolled edges, and they have a unique life history that comes from a little reproductive propagule called a turion. It looks like a rubbery pine cone, and this thing is growing in the winter where it's native in Europe. It's growing in the winter time, and so it's got a huge advantage over a lot of these natives that it's actually starting its growth in the middle of winter. In years like we just had across the Midwest, there's very little snow, very little ice, and they're starting to grow early on in the winter. And they're building up. And then when the ice cover comes off and the water temperatures come up, then they just really go hog wild. You see lakes that are shallow lakes that mat out with curlew leaf in May and June. And then right around the end of June, first week of July, usually before the 4th of July, it senesces and lays down for the season. The plant breaks apart and it releases lots and lots of phosphorus, and that fuels these big algae blooms. So it's kind of like this plant set itself up to be really successful, to keep a lake in a clear water state. And then all of a sudden it dies off and it closes the door behind it. It releases all this phosphorus. The lake becomes very turbid and no other native plants grow very well. Now, despite that role that it plays, it's still, as an exotic, as an invasive, it still provides a ton of habitat value. That clear water state and that vegetation is embraced by a lot of fish species. There's a lot of lakes in portions of the Midwest that it's one of the few plants that will grow in very turbid conditions and will kind of set up and provide some habitat value to fish that require having aquatic plants as part of their habitat requirements. So it does serve a purpose. That's one of the first ones people are going to cue in on. Coontail is another one, Elodea or Canada waterweed. These are a couple. In the case of coontail, it's not a rooted plant. It actually free floating, but is a, fully formed macrophyte. And a lot of times you see when the wind gets really heavy, these things will roll up on shore just because, again, they're not rooted to the ground. So you'll see huge mats of it. It is a native, but it can become invasive in a way. That Canada waterweed will kind of still run the same way, and it'll stay green. These are two plants that often stay green throughout the year. But if you're finding edges of coontail, you're finding where it grows up almost vertically up and down, creates walls. Those are nice edges for fish. Same thing for the Canada waterweed. So a couple of those plants that early on in the spring you can key in on. Now, we have a year like this. We have a year like 2023, 2024. We have almost no winter. We have an amazing early ice out. And while of late, as I'm talking to you, we've had a blast of cold weather for a couple of weeks that probably puts us a little closer to being on track to what a normal spring would be. That being said, we're due for another heat blast, and we expect water temperatures are going to shoot right up. And so in doing that, our natives are going to respond. Our natives are going to perk up. They're going to grow. And that's where, if you're an angler, maybe if you were looking at curly leaf edges, you were looking at coontail, you were looking at Canada waterweed. Now it's starting to look at, what are the other natives that are coming along? Do we have some of that cabbage coming up? Is it large leaf pondweed, Illinois pondweed, clasping leaf pondweed, white stem pondweed? Is it any other number of plants getting established? Is it bushy pondweed? Is it is it some of our grasses that are coming up? Vallisneria. We can go through some of the different plant species, but you see that response, and you can really start to cue in on those locations and take advantage, because the fish are up shallow. It's spring. It's the idiot days of fishing, where you can catch them just about everywhere, and getting on vegetation inside and outside weed lines into that spring pattern is pretty dynamite fishing.
Do you feel like, just what you know about these weeds, fishing different weed types, to just sort of give you maybe a different strategy as to how to fish them, just based on the size and shape, the density of them?
Yeah, well, I'll answer it in two ways from an angling perspective. The first thing you want to be thinking about as an angler is, this will change your way of thinking about it a little bit, is where is the photic zone? What does that mean in layman's terms? Well, you're out on a lake, and if you've researched your lake and you looked into it and you know what kind of water clarity you have, if you've got really good Secchi disc readings, if you're going down 10, 15, 20 feet, exceptional water clarity, right? Our photic zone, or the area where plants will grow, where sunlight penetration reaches to, is going to be quite expansive. It's going to go down quite a ways. And that means we've got a huge area around the lake. If you're setting your depth finder up, and we have an idea of, hey, it's a sunny day and I got my polarized lenses on and I'm sitting on the bow of my boat and I'm motoring out. And even if we don't have a report of what the Secchi disc reading is, you can get it for that individual day, because it's not like it's a static number throughout the year. It's going to change as the season progresses and what happens with nutrients and availability and plankton and tannin staining and water input. So our water clarity levels are going to change throughout the year, but you're sitting there on the bow of your boat and you're motoring forward with your bow mount down, and just see how far you can down. You can look down, have that depth finder reading going, and go, okay, I'm at 15. I can still see bottom 16, or maybe it's just 6 feet, or maybe it goes away at 7 foot, wherever it is. But try to lock that into your brain about where that point was where I couldn't see bottom anymore. Or if you're really concerned about it, put on a big bright colored jig and drop that thing down and watch that and figure out at what point that thing disappears. That is the end of your photic zone, where sunlight penetration stops, where plant growth is going to stop. Whatever we identify that depth to, that's going to be our endpoint. So if we're going into our electronics and we're eliminating everything, if we're weed fishing that day and we're going to eliminate everything that's deeper than 7 foot, 10 foot, 12 foot, 15, whatever it is, that's going to help narrow down some of the water if we're weed fishing that particular day. So that's one thing I would do as an angler. The next approach I would take to looking at these plants is to think about it with the Little Red Riding Hood mentality. What I mean by that is we're looking at all this submerged vegetation. We want to see a healthy mix of different plant types. It's typically better to have that, right? We don't just want a monoculture of the same plant. You know, that's the argument to be made about biodiversity, not having a single dominant invasive plant that just, you know, covers the entire lake. Yeah. Hey, Eurasian water milfoil is good for bass anglers. You can't deny it, because it grows out to deeper depths of water and it does well in places maybe that natives can't. That being said, if your choice was between a really diverse mix of plants or just a singular wall of Eurasian water milfoil, you would want that diverse mix. So setting that aside, back to this Goldilocks analogy, we're looking at our plant growth. Now, we see spots that have a plant here or there. That's too thin to hold fish. We go a little further down the lake, we see just an incredible wall, an impenetrable wall of plants. That's probably too thick to hold many fish. When we start to find that spot that's right in the middle, that's got a good healthy chunk of plants with some spaces in between, some pockets, that's our just right medium location. And I tell you what, enough folks that are listening in the audience have experienced that, where you go out and you find those pockets and you find those little holes and you find those spots where, again, it's kind of that contrast. You've got edges to fish and you've got a medium amount of plants. Those are the places that like to hold a lot of fish. That's what you're looking for as an angler for aquatic vegetation fishing.
This episode of the JMO Podcast is brought to you by Chalet on Mille Lacs. The Chalet on Mille Lacs has all your lodging needs and more for your next vacation on Mille Lacs Lake near Garrison, Minnesota. And when I say this lodging opportunity has all your needs and more, I'm talking about two private shorelines, including a protected channel to safely park your boat overnight, a great outdoor feature you're not going to find everywhere on the lake, a game room, high-speed Wi-Fi, you're minutes away from the casino and golf course. The indoor and outdoor amenities of the Chalet on Mille Lacs epitomize comfort and convenience with a 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom that includes 2 masters, a large kitchen, all the indoor amenities that are perfect for large groups or multi-families. This cabin comfortably sleeps 8. You can add more if you like. Read the reviews from past guests on the website or book directly at Chalet on Mille Lacs. That's www.chaletonmillelacs.com. The link is in the description of this podcast. Man, just everything you just said there, as you described the edges, and we're fishing the edge, the transition from, or I think a lot of anglers might think that is weeds to no weeds. Maybe it's a bottom composition, or it's where the light penetration ends and it's just from weeds to no weeds. I think it's important to point out that edge habitat also means one weed type transitioning to another weed type. Like you said, when the presence of, when there's multiple weed, like that's a transition. That's edge habitat. And I think it's important to point that out. Any elaboration on that, I just think is really, definitely really meaningful. But I also want to ask you directly, or how do we sort of talk about Or has there been anything meaningful in this regard with the, clear water? You know, the zebra mussels really sort of lead the charge in that conversation with clearing up, or a lot of water clarity. But there's been examples of clear water since forever, like deep weeds on lakes that are going through that sort of cycle. And we're finding weeds deeper than we ever have before. Are there any trends there?
Well, I think you're right. There's some plants that are going to respond favorably. And just in general, if you increase that photic zone and light can penetrate a little bit deeper, there is a plant response to it. Absolutely. It's just who wins the battle of competition. Nature has its arms race, and what plant is going to respond fastest and colonize that area. It's just like any form of floral succession. So, to answer that, it just sort of depends what you can find down there. In my experience, you might see the Kara or muskgrass that we talked about earlier carpeting the bottom of the lake. That macroalgae, it may spread down there if they're present. You may see some of that coontail or waterweed that'll go out to those kinds of depths. Now, sometimes it's the larger rooted plants that start growing up as well. But a lot of folks go, well, geez, yeah, I mean, plant growth is extending deeper. Well, that must be something better, or that must be a new opportunity to exploit. And I heard you mention zebra mussels. One of the interesting things I heard at a recent natural resources conference was talking about energy shifts in where are you going to find fish foraging and spending their time. And the assumption was always, well, it's getting water clarity is improving or is increasing, transparency is increasing, and we're seeing greater water quality. And the assumption was, well, that just means that there'll be more fish that are able to utilize that sunlight penetration and get to those areas. Well, what they're finding instead is, with zebra mussels tying up so much of that energy into the bottom of the lake that it's taking away from some of those pelagic or open water fish, and it's moving more fish up into shallow water. So interestingly enough, even though you think, oh, they're going to be sick, they're not going to want to spend time in shallow water where they're vulnerable, or, if they don't want it, like a fish like walleye that doesn't want to spend a bunch of time in really bright light, well, that's the only place they're finding their food. So they're actually finding more foraging going on in shallow water habitats. Again, this being linked to some diet studies that have looked at stable isotopes and where you're going to find those in open water deep areas versus shallow water habitats, and the species that are represented, the prey items that are represented in those locations. The shift has been to shallow water. So what do you do as an angler? Well, in the past where you'd think, the response is, well, you're absolutely right, you're going to have to make a change. This is a fundamentally changed system now that zebra mussels are introduced. But it's not always, oh, we'll go out at night or we'll go fish deeper. In fact, you might have to do the opposite. You might have to pound those shallow areas and especially get on those shallow vegetation edges. Those are going to be holding more fish because that's where they're finding their prey.
I think that's a huge part of this. And I had a one of your colleagues, Luke Scalicamp. He's a Otter Tail County guy.
Yeah.
And, I had him on. We were talking zebra mussels. He did a great job to describing everything you just said, is that it's sort of a fascinating thing to imagine zebra mussels when they're small, when they're early in life, and they're just floating out in the ocean, essentially eating or foraging or consuming. But when they colonize, like, they end up bringing all that energy into the shallow water. And they're just like a big seining. Like in my head, I was like, well, they're just like a big seining net where it just goes out there and feeds on all the energy and then brings it in shallow where they, where they kind of late stage or colonize or whatever. And I think it makes perfect sense. That being said, I kind of wanted to get back into what kind of a rabbit hole we could get into with the current conditions, like this mild winter that we just had across the Midwest. Where, or anywhere that we get ice where, we just sort of, typically we have a winter and it breaks down the weeds. But this year there's going to be lots of examples where that's not happening. And maybe it's not the entire lake, but maybe some of the best or most prominent weed beds or just, the weed or aquatic vegetation, where the vegetation survived the best. I feel like you know, is it crazy for me to think, you know, that is some of those areas where maybe there's a stutter step with these weeds that are just trying, they're trying to, you know, make it through this mild winter conditions. And, you know, maybe that causes a hiccup with regrowth or the younger, you know, the young of the year type of weeds or the new shoots. Like, is there any sort of, you know, any sort of speculation? Is there anything along those lines where, you know, maybe these fish were loving these weeds that stayed a little bit green all winter, but anywhere that the weeds did break down is going to, you know, it's going to have that more natural life cycle. Maybe those fish are going to find new areas where they find new emerging weeds versus these standing stocks. They're, you know, they're trying to survive, but maybe they're just not as fertile or whatever it is. Like, is there any sort of a conversation there, any sort of a speculation on your part with some of these weeds?
Well, I'll say this. So we talk about how to utilize tools that are at a fisherman's disposal, at an angler's disposal. And certainly a lot of the focus of late has been on sonar topics. We talked about side scanning, and, you know, that can be a part of this topic of aquatic vegetation, the high density or high definition side imaging, as well as the forward facing sonar, gives an incredible image return that you can start to get down to brass tacks of having a pretty good idea of what type or what species of aquatic plants are growing out there. So you can absolutely turn to that once they've gotten established. But I think one of the other tools that sometimes gets overlooked, it had its time and place and its heyday, was probably, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, when it hit the market, underwater cameras, especially as they transition to color. And I know everyone doesn't want to spend a bunch of time dropping a camera down, because it's not like you're looking at the camera and fishing at the same time, although sometimes you can do both. But it's a scouting tool, right? Like, you want to know what are your substrates, which you can sometimes get from returns from sonar. But this is the foolproof way of either positively identifying fish, which might get replaced with forward-facing sonar and the high definition that it represents, but it's probably never going to be a substitute for finding out if aquatic vegetation is green or brown, if it's photosynthesizing and up or not. To your point about the winter, you're right. I mean, we have natives that they'll have a low level of photosynthesis at a very reduced rate under the ice. In the spring, they'll develop fresh green shoots on the ends of stems, and just start to see them perk up and pick up. And once those water temperatures hit the right rate, they really take off. So you're 100% right that a year like this, even our native plants are just sitting on the edge, teetering and waiting for those right conditions. We're going to have real good sunlight penetration. We're going to get a heat wave coming through. The water temps are going to shoot up and everything's going to take off. And you're going to want to be on the water those days. Early in the spring period where it really takes off and the fish are just gluttonous.
I think that for anybody that does get triggered by this or does get interested in this and goes out and just spends a little bit more time, you know, and to your point with the cameras, I don't think anybody's going to waste their time trying to find fish with a camera, right? That'd be crazy. But man, I tell you what, how useful. I mean, the tournament guys have been doing it forever and they still do. Like, it's when you do find fish though, and you want to find out, like, gosh, why was that my best spot today? Like, why was everything happening in that spot or those two spots that look the exact same? Man, that's where a camera comes in handy. You can work backwards and you can really, really, I mean, it can just be so eye-opening, and you're spot on. Like, you know, all this vegetation on the electronics might look very similar. Like, you might not be able to see the difference whatsoever, but most of the fish, you know, or your success sort of happened in these really, you know, these certain areas. You can drop that camera down. We've done it. Definitely ice fishing, where you drop it down and you can just pan it around where directionally all the weeds one way are just brown and all the weeds the other way are green or greener. Like, there's for whatever reason, there's a transition there. But the weeds that are brown, they still stand as, it's the same type of weed. You know, it's just oxygen levels, whatever it is. Like, you know, you talk about through the ice, like, you know, where snow builds up or where cracks form, where there's bare ice, the wind blows off. Light penetration keeps them things green just a little bit. That stuff you cannot see on forward sonar. And so, yeah, like that is, I'm really glad you brought that up. That definitely brings it full circle for, you know, the anglers that are ready to be nuancy about this stuff.
I'll sell a few more folks if they're not already sold on the importance of knowing their aquatic plants or paying attention to what happens. Consider this. So we are in the Midwest and we are blessed with natural lakes. Now the rest of our society and fellow anglers that are in the American West or Southwest or Southeast or even in the East Coast, they do not have the same blessing, and they have a lot of reservoirs, right? And these reservoirs drop off so quickly that they have almost no aquatic vegetation component to them. Midwest anglers are just so keyed in on aquatic plants, and for good reason, right? It's a huge part of what we have in these lakes, and the fish are tied to it. I mean, we can play the word association game. You can give me a fish species and I can probably rattle off a plant that we would associate with it. So you want to throw a couple at me? Give me a couple popular game fish.
Dude, yeah. In fact, here's the note that I have written down. It's species preferences. I wasn't even sure how I was going to formulate the question. So yes, you are helping me pivot into this exact thing that I had written down. Species preferences. Like any, you know, if you're in Minnesota or Wisconsin, and you're fishing a natural inland lake and it's a walleye opener and it's, you know, we have this early ice out. I'm just describing this year, like it's an early ice out. So it's not unrealistic to imagine, especially in the southern portion of the Midwest, that there is going to be some established emerging aquatic vegetation. What are we going to be looking for walleyes? What's going to be the weed type that could set the day apart?
Well, I would probably start in the southern part of the state where I see a lot of that curly leaf pondweed. I'd be trying to get on the edges of that. If I don't have curly leaf present, I might see if I can find a nice coontail Canada waterweed edge early in the year. And honestly, you know, if you're getting on first breaks and it's real shallow, anywhere from as little as 3 feet to as deep as, you know, I don't know, 10, 12, wherever you're finding that aquatic vegetation line, you're probably going to be able to look down and see what's coming up, what's growing, or maybe you're going to hook some of it and you're going to know that you're in the right place trying to get on that edge. So walleye is definitely one that you're uptight on. Absolutely.
The next one's going to be crappies. Again, this year, we're just describing this year with the early ice out. Everything is just, I mean, and the guys have been for weeks now, especially down in the metro, really had the early ice out, you know, down in your part of the world, you know, the crappie fishing down there. But let's, you know, again, right in and around that, the big game fish opener where you're talking mid-May, if a guy was going to get out for a week or two before that, right? So, you know, that early part of May, black crappies.
I mean, I would throw out cattail and bulrush almost interchangeably as we talk about associations with black crappies. And there's a number of fish that are really going to be keyed in on emergent plants, and emergents just have this great important role, you know, from a ecosystem services point of view. They're taking up nutrients, they're nesting habitat for birds, they're holding cover for fish. They're an edge. I mean, how many underwater photos have we seen of bass or pike or sunfish or crappie cruising those edges? And then when you think about the perspective of getting on top of them, when you're looking down, right, this is where it really excels. Pre-spawn or spawning fish, you know, back to the crappie question, you're hanging up high, you got your polarized lenses. Last year's old growth, either cattails or bulrushes, is sitting there like it got mowed off clean by a lawnmower. You know, the top leaves have fallen off and stems have fallen down. Last year's brown portions are left. Maybe some new green shoots are coming up. And it's relatively flat like a lawnmower went over it. And there's patches in between there, right? Those are the places where you see those dark black spawning coloration crappies cruising around through. And that's just like that magical thing of you're out there with grandpa in the cane pole, or you're casting a winget bobber in there, or whatever it is. You know, those are those fun times that you have that you never forget, catching a bunch of paper mouse in the spring of the year. So that habitat association with emergent plants, with cattails, with hard stem and soft stem bulrush, maybe you see some burr reed, maybe you see some river bulrush, all those plants, even spycrush or horsetail, right? You think about those big, you know, or scouring rush, right? You think they're segmented, they're green and they're hollow. Those are the kinds of plants that we're looking for, emergent plants up shallow. And the beauty of that is you don't need to have an underwater camera. You don't need to have any fancy sonar. You can read the vegetation from the water surface up and know what's going to be below.
In my mind, I'm asking the question because I'm selfish and I have this vivid image in my head of like what I'm asking you. And on my favorite lake to fish in the spring, whether I'm out before the opener or even I like fishing crappies, like even after the opener, right? Like a whatever. But that's, you know, what those black spawning color crappies are right along the, you know, sometimes I would say it's more of a cattail-y sure. spot than a bulrush.
Yes.
But man, it's right where they meet. I feel like that's that comorbidity where, you know, that's that edge. It's not necessarily an edge from you know, vegetation or certain plant to nothing. It's from one plant to the other. The edge where the two types of plants meet is like just this awesome little funnel. I love the way you described that way better than I would have. But and then, you know, would it be worth maybe to, you know, getting after some forage species? I mean, you know, these fish that we're trying to catch are in there, you know, whether it's for spawning reasons or, you know, post-spawn walleyes come mid-May, like we're talking. I mean, a lot of times they're in there because what they're trying to eat is in there. What would be some forage species, you know, whether it's shiners or, you know, perch, like any of the spring spawners, maybe is there a way we can talk about how they capitalize on, you know, on some of the shallow vegetation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we think about our littoral or shallow water areas as being the nursery of the lake. So any of the waters that are under 15 feet, that tends to be shallow and warmest in the spring and summer. And, you know, just very productive and lots of vegetation that grows in there. And then correspondingly, you see the response that comes with primary and secondary production, a fancy way of saying that we've got our plants growing and then we've got our consumers. We've got aquatic insects, we've got zooplankton hanging in an area, and that's going to have a kind of a food chain reaction of sorts, you could call it, right? Then the next thing is there's going to be some small fish that are going to go in and key in on that. Larger fish are going to chase them, and the whole food chain is all of a sudden now drifting to the shallowest portion of the lake. And until those forage species get off their first spawn of the year in the calendar year, everybody's looking for a meal and they're coming up shallow because resources are limited. Until those new shiners are produced, until some of those first, respective insect hatches. Of course, there's different insects that are hatching throughout the year, winter, early spring, so on and so forth. But most of that's happening according to water temperature. So the warmer it gets, the more production happens, the more insect life is up there. Same with zooplankton. So everything's cashing in on that. And that's another reason just to get in and work those plants early in the year. And all seasons, I don't mean to just focus on it being an early pattern, but that's always present, right? There's always foraging opportunities. If you're willing to go shallow as a fish, there's always prey availability in those areas.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Good point there. It's an all year round conversation. I just don't typically do like 4-hour podcasts, but yes, we could definitely, I'm glad that you've been cool with kind of, you know, trying to kind of stick to this time of year. Cause I feel like it just keeps us from going way too far, you know, into the weeds, you know, pun intended, but it's like, you know, gosh, cause yeah, like I think different times of year do have a lot to do with the pattern and things like that. You know, we're touching on some of the key, you know, some of the groundwork that's just going to get you started, you know, into this, you know, into these topics, if it's, interests you that way. But yeah, like, I think we could talk for 4 or 5 hours. And, you know, I mean, like another thing that I just haven't even addressed, cause I think I'll probably do this on a different podcast altogether. You know, flooded terrestrial vegetation, you know, just like, you know, like dry land, like flooded, that's a big thing out here on our reservoirs. Oh, yeah. You know, you were talking about that. Reservoirs are across the country. Everybody knows what that is with water fluctuation and, you know, spring runoff. But again, you know, we would be sitting here for 4 hours and
Right.
And it's just, you know, we're just limited that way. Or I'm trying to limit you that way so that, you know, we can get on with our lives until next time, I guess. But yeah, no, I definitely think, you know, whether it's for myself and just a lot of people, you know, just the, you know, the average angler out there, I think it's okay to say that we don't all know enough about the weed types. And once we get a lot of other things figured out, or some of our priorities figured out in terms of fishing and just some of our strategy, I think there does reach a point where, you know, if you started to learn more about, you know, these types of topics and the, you know, the aquatic plants would help you be a better angler, you know, would help you put patterns together, that you could, you know, capitalize on throughout a day on a particular lake, but also season to season or from lake to lake. I think that's true. If you're in fishing a certain region where there's just a lot of similarities or just things, I think that thought process is very, very, could be, you know, just very, very, you know, useful and just to add in somebody's success. But anyways, let's have a closer here. Is there anything, you know, a couple minutes? I mean, we're good on time here. So anything else that we have to add? Probably a lot of things, but we can have you back on, Scott, and do this. But what would be something we can close out on?
I'll give you a couple things. I just think, you know, we were hitting on the word association, and we did crappies, we did walleyes. I think, you know, I won't drag this out, but muskies, right? Large leaf pondweed, find the biggest cabbage that you can, again, of a medium consistency. And when you find those places, mark those beds. If they're as small as the size of your living room or they're giant, you know, mark them, because those are great spots that hold fish. You could make the same case for pike. Our associates love to hang out in these types of aquatic plant stands. Largemouth bass, right? We talked a little bit already about emergent plants and that those fish will cruise those edges, particularly in the spring. But really the word association I think about with largemouth bass is fish in pads, right? Floating leaf aquatic plants, if it's the little tiny water shields that feel gelatinous underneath the small floating leaf plants, those are water shield. It could be the bigger ones like yellow water lily or white yellow pond lily or white water lily. It could be spatter dock, which is a kind of a variant of that yellow lily, or it could be those great big elephant ears. They're not super common in the Midwest, but they're on the Minnesota River. Those elephant ears that are called American lotus, those giant floating leaf plants. So a word association with bass, even sunfish. You know, I tell a lot of folks at different lake associations or sportsmen's clubs, if you want to catch sunfish, you want a good bluegill lake, go to somewhere that has really abundant aquatic vegetation. Same for yellow perch, same for black crappie. Any of our panfish are really aquatic plant loving fish. So, you know, we talked a little bit already about the edges. Those are great. If you're looking for an inside scoop, pay attention to where there's a nice prop wash path. We talk about fish being a creature of edge. Many times you can fish right down an old prop wash path, you know, cleared out spot through vegetation. It's a nice edge that's been created by someone motoring through plants. That's a great place to fish if you're looking for one little tip or trick to try. And I guess the last closer to leave with is, hey, we have a few folks that are diehard anglers that live on lakes. Maybe they're very serious hunters that live on small ponds. Think about aquatic vegetation restoration, setting your shorelines back to a natural state, really getting back to the plants and the trees and the shrubs and the things that make it go wild again. Those are the places that provide the best available habitat. I've often argued that the best thing we can do is acquire a piece of land on a lake or pond and leave it the heck alone, right? We don't plant turf grass. We don't riprap the edge. We just let Mother Nature take her course, and she's probably going to provide excellent habitat.
Yeah, one other thing that just pops into my head is like, you know, I think when I got more comfortable with, you know, fishing in the vegetation, getting in and around these, you know, places where these fish live, and starting to understand it more, it was kind of a daunting task for me. I just didn't like the idea of like grinding through weeds all day, getting your lure followed up all the time. Like I didn't know how to fish it all the time. But one other thing that I just thought was almost nonsense when I first started to listen to conversations, you know, where people just get really prejudiced about a certain weed type for a certain species, or, you know, catching walleyes in, or, you know, all the best spots on a particular lake is so narrowly focused to like one weed type. I just thought a lot of that was nonsense. But one thing, you know, I've learned to embrace that can definitely happen. And, you know, another example that's, you know, I feel like is kind of a, you know, just a, like a good comparison, but it's easier to wrap my head around to kind of help me with all this, like bass anglers, you know, fishing docks, right? Like docks are habitat for bass. And certain times of year, especially like colder water, like, you know, like spring or fall, where there can be a stretch of 100 docks, but only the minority docks that have, you know, wood pylons, just because they heat up, they create habitat different than, say, like the aluminum or the steel frame docks or the floating docks that are out there. Like, if the docks can be that significantly different, you know, from each other, for those types of fine details, you know, the vegetation, when we're fishing around aquatic plants, why can't that also be true? And once I triggered that, because, you know, there might be a reason why the forage absolutely chooses to live in and around, given certain circumstances, in and around certain weed type or certain plants that we're fishing around, and that then the predators are going to be in there. So it can definitely happen. It can definitely happen. I guess in my mind, I'm not the expert, but like, this can definitely happen, where if you can, you know, you get a few bites and you start to realize that there's a plant type that is producing, don't be scared of that being true.
Well, and you're spot on. I mean, I think about bass tournaments are held and anglers come to the scales talking about they can't believe how many walleyes they caught fish and veg, or
yeah,
vice versa, right? People find fish where they don't expect them, and it opens their mind to there's a broader pattern that they're missing out on. The one thing that your story reminds me of too is make sure that you are effective as an angler in vegetation. Make sure you know how to rig up and fish in vegetation. You know, I can remember being a young novice, and the first largemouth bass I caught, I casted a crankbait over and over into the same slot pile until finally I got lucky and I didn't fall weeds and caught a fish before it got fouled up. You know, had I known better, I would have started to rig up weedless. I would have put on weed guards. I would have rigged into a plastic. So many ways to fish effectively and hide a hook. And, you know, credit to bass anglers and their widespread adoption of plastic lures and different varieties and ways to rig them and how to punch through vegetation and fish it differently. A lot of us can learn from those folks and be more effective in fishing the vegetation. So it's not always a turnoff. So we don't always have to go try to find a weed edge. We can look for other parts of it. So if you can be an effective vegetation angler, it goes a long way.
There it is, man. Well, we'll wrap it up, dude. Scott, I appreciate the time as always. Information is spectacular. I think that this is exactly what I was looking for, at least for the first edition on this. We'll see where it takes us. But, dude, thank you so much, man. We'll
All talk right. to you. Take care, man. Thank you.